From the street to the stadium, the catwalk to the court. For your fitness gear and festival look, now's your chance to sport the three stripes and stock up on the best of Adidas. Save up to 50% on selected items. Visit adidas.co.uk now.
Ahoy Mets fans, welcome to episode 192 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. I am Brian Salvatore, and this has been a week, ain't it? This has not been one of the best weeks to be a Mets fan this year. We've seen our fair share of injury, we've seen our fair share of losses, we've seen our fair share of Daniel Murphy. But we're going to get through this together. The season's not over yet. There is still reason to be optimistic. And we are going to do that throughout a number of segments this week, try and look on the bright side of things. But first up, I have a conversation with Chris McShane where we answer your questions and talk about the general state of the Mets as we are sitting here at the end of June 2016. Okay, we are here to answer your emails, questions, talk about the Mets, all that sort of stuff. As always, you can email the show at podcast@amazonavenueaudio.com or tweet at us at Brian Needs a Nap, at Chris McShane, or at Amazon Avenue. Our email this week comes from, what's this gentleman's name? Dave, there we go. Comes from Dave. Hey, pod hosts. Not to overreact to a couple of losses to the Nationals, but let's just say, taking a pragmatic look at possible scenario, the wheels come totally off over the next couple of weeks and we realize this is not our year. Could we profit by going into sell mode? What could we get for Cespedes and Walker, guys who will almost certainly be free agents anyway? And would that be more useful than waiting for the comp picks that might generate by signing with other teams? Might anybody else be for sale? Sorry if it bummed you out. Hopefully this question ends up looking silly in the rearview mirror. Thanks, Dave. Well, Chris, you sort of take the approach whenever we talk about this stuff of the long view and not getting too worried about a couple of losses. Which, you know, I aspire to in my fandom, but I don't always get to live in that reality. Sometimes I can get a little panicky myself. But I think this is a valid question. Let's say that, you know, July 1st is Friday. Let's say that by July 20th, the Mets have lost, you know, 10 of their last 15. And Duda doesn't look like he's coming back anytime soon, and the bone spurs in Matz's and Syndergaard's elbows look worse, and David Wright's leg falls off, or whatever terrible things could happen between now and sort of the days right before the trade deadline. Do you think the Mets as sellers make sense?
Yeah, it could. I'm not ready to entertain that yet, but if it's really worst case scenario from here over, you know, the next 3 weeks and everything you just said happens, you could definitely trade away a couple guys and get back significant returns. You know, you hate to give up on a season. I'd much rather they still be, even if they're not, you know, closing in on first place, even if they're still hanging around in the wild card, I'd much rather things go the other way. But if things really go down the drain, I have very little doubt that they could get something significant for Neil Walker. I really don't want to see Cespedes go because I'd still rather him get to the end of the season and say, hey, you know, I won't opt out if you add another year or two.
Right.
That's, you know, this salary.
Yeah, Cespedes is a different story than Walker is for sure.
Yeah, and Walker would be easier to sell because, and this sort of is a little foreshadowing for our tweet question, which, mm-hmm. if you're listening, emails are always welcome, but if you want to tweet a question at us, by all means.
Please do, yes.
Go ahead. So if you get you know, if you get to that spot and things are really terrible and you just want to sell Walker, you know, Dilson Herrera could come up and potentially be not that big of a drop off from him anyway.
Yeah.
And I like Walker a lot. I like Herrera a lot. So that's a guy who you could sell if you're in that mode.
I also think that if you're going to attempt that, you could sell Walker even if you're not giving up on the season.
Right.
That if something happens in the next few weeks and you see a glaring need for the Mets and they're looking at their roster and how can we improve our roster, well, trading Walker for another kind of piece, that might be an option out there. You're not going to get somebody of equal value in the majors necessarily, because it's very rare that even trades happen at the deadline. You know, even in terms of talent today for talent today, that doesn't tend to happen as much. You're gonna find somebody who's looking to rebuild a little bit for next year or for beyond. But I do think that what's interesting about the Mets situation here is that, with the exception of Walker, and if we go under the presumption that Cespedes doesn't opt out, I know that's a silly assumption, but let's just go with it for a second. If that's the case, their prognosis for next year doesn't look demonstratively worse than their prognosis was for this year. And so they're not going to sell in the way that... This isn't their last year in their window, let's put it that way. They're not going to be selling in the extreme way that sometimes teams do if they're going for it one last time and then realize they have a couple of lean years ahead. The Mets are very much going to be in contention next year, no matter what happens this year. So I think that might limit the amount of selling they do at the trade deadline also.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you look around the roster and I don't see too many other guys who you might trade. You know, I guess in a similar vein, you know, Bartolo Colon could be available. You know, that's sort of, if you really are giving up on 2016, because, you know, he's been really good, and he's been, even if he's not that good the rest of the way, he's been as durable a starter as they've had.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, a couple guys in the bullpen could conceivably be traded, but, you know, I think they'd want to get more back for somebody like Addison Reed than they gave up to get him, because right. He's been just so great since he made the switch over to, you know, playing for the Mets. But yeah, I think any of those guys can get you a return that is good, and I understand that the farm system is, you know, not what it was a couple of years ago, because all of its best players are on the big league team now, or, you know, in the case of Michael Fulmer, were traded away to get somebody else who really helped the major league team.
Or in the case of Michael Conforto, was on the major league team and is just being retooled a little bit now in the minors.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Conforto might be actually one of the reasons why I'm feeling like not all is lost, because I just think I don't want to put too much stock into what he did from July through the end of April. But, you know, that was enough to show what he's capable of.
And that's three quarters of a season.
Right. It's not, you know, you really have to see a guy do something over the course of...
Yeah.
Yeah. But you want to see a guy do something over the course of, you know, a year or two or three before you can really say, oh, that's who he is. But but yeah, he could, I could see him back here sooner than later and looking like a good hitter again.
Absolutely. Is there a date or a number of games out of first place that you have in mind for when your optimism runs out?
I mean, I guess if we get into double digits, that... double digits on any date would be enough, but I keep going back to the wild card still being an option. You know, there's the three division leaders as we're recording this right now, and then there's four teams that are over 500, and they're all either tied with each other or within a game of each other for the wild card spots, right? So I think division wise, if it gets to double digits, that's when I start to go, okay, like it would take something crazy to win the NL East. But in terms of really giving up on the season, I think it would be falling significantly out of the wild card race.
And the four teams that are in the wild card race right now, it's the Pirates, the Mets, the Marlins, and I'm blanking on the fourth.
Dodgers.
I think that the Dodgers and the Pirates are the ones I would worry about. I can't see Miami continuing at this pace.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you never know. And they're there. Yeah. They're still there right now. But yeah, it's the Dodgers and Pirates. And the Pirates have had a free fall that has been steeper than what the Mets have done in their struggles.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, but then again, McCutchen's looked so bad this year. If he starts to heat up a little bit, that could be a relatively major difference maker for the Pirates.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's no given that, you know, that they're going to be beatable and that they don't get themselves into a strong wild card position. But yeah, that's what it would take for me to start going like, that ticket plan, those September games, they're just, that wasn't a great idea, and, you know, start thinking about what happens in the off season. I think getting to a point in the wild card that there's either, you know, a significant game gap, so 4 or 5 games out of a wild card spot, or, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 teams out of a wild card spot. That,
right.
You know, that's something that gets really significant there. And, you know, I think I've said this before, the wild card is certainly not the goal, that's not the prize, but, you know, it's if you figure you have a 50-50 shot of winning that game, if you get there, I think it's worth keeping your guys to have you have a chance to make it back to the World Series if you can get into that game. So
I agree. I feel like we are we're on the very fringe of Panic City right now.
Yes.
But there are some Mets fans who are living in the heart of it already.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we alluded to this earlier. Spiker is awesome on Twitter, tweeted at us and said, Dilson Herrera, up before September or nah? Well, what would have to happen for Herrera to be called up before September? I think you'd have to have Walker either traded away or playing third base more or less full time.
Yeah.
And
so let's say Jose Reyes is either really bad or pulls a hammy.
Mm-hmm. Both of which seem like very likely options at this point.
Neither one of those things would surprise me.
Yeah.
If for some reason he's incapable of playing, whatever the reason, then I think that could happen. You know, we've seen a bunch of teams are interested in Curiel. Sandy Alderson certainly hasn't ruled it out. It would be surprising if the Mets signed him, but, you know, they've been one of the teams he's had a private workout with, and
he tweeted himself in Mets gear.
Yes, as he's done at every stop along the way, but right. Yeah. But, you know, perhaps they go out and they make a move, but if they're sort of in this same position of hanging in there and Reyes can't cut it, then that to me is the obvious way of like, hey, Nail, you've been great, and we know you're not looking to be a third baseman when you hit free agency, but just for the sake of this team and this season, give third base a real shot and get Herrera up, just because, you know, at some point, I would think if you called both of them up in 2 weeks, well, I'll give Reyes the full time to, play minor league games and get back into the hang of playing baseball, because there was almost a 2-week break where he didn't play in a game after the Rockies cut him.
Right.
So give it 2 more weeks, come up, you know, I know Reyes has the stolen base ability, but as a hitter, I had actually put my money on Herrera being the better hitter of the two.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think Herrera at this point in his career has far more upside than Reyes has at this point in his career.
I mean, I'd actually kind of prefer that they, you know, say Reyes makes it back, he knocks the 25th man off the roster. You know, I'd rather have him be sort of pinch runner, maybe play once or twice a week kind of thing, and then do the Dilson Herrera Walker shuffle in combination with it. So, you know, I guess it is possible to have all three of them on the roster at the same time. But I would, yeah, it's a long answer. But the short answer to the question is I think he's absolutely up before September, because if any infielder gets hurt or if Reyes is bad, that seems to be the next solution to go to before having to either pay Gurriel or give up prospects to trade for somebody else.
Yeah. I agree with that wholeheartedly. I actually think that the most likely outcome of the Reyes situation is that he starts, you know, I've heard rumblings of he's going to be called up on a Friday. Have you heard that as well?
I actually had not.
Okay.
I hope not. I'd like to see him get more than, at the time that we're recording, this one hit in his minor league stint.
Yeah, yeah.
Before he comes up.
I'm going to the game on Sunday, and I don't think I want to deal with the personal emotions of being at a Reyes game this early. I'm still working through how I feel about all of this.
Right.
You know, we're not going to get into that. We talked about that last week, but you know, you understand what I'm saying.
I do. Being there for that first, because there's going to be a loud Jose chant.
Yes, there is.
In his first game back at home, and I don't know. I you know, one of the things, and we won't go too far into it, but one of the things that Sandy Alderson said in talking about it was that it was a second chance with conditions, right?
Right.
It was a conditions or a word similar to that. So that would be more how I would hope the initial reaction is, and I know that's not going to be the case. So
I was at a barbecue on Saturday with my brother-in-law and his family, and they had some friends coming over, and the one friend was a Mets fan, and he walked in the backyard and just started doing the Jose, Jose, Jose chant, and like pumping his fists in the air, and he was all excited about it. And I was just thinking, like, I can't get on board with that yet. I just can't do it.
Right.
You know, I know he released a written statement and all that, but I'm not ready. I'm not there yet. So anyway, what I was saying was, I really think that the most likely scenario here is that Reyes is going to start a dozen games for the Mets. I don't think he's going to have that much left in the tank, and I think you're going to see him in more of that bench role, because I don't see the Mets being as quick with cutting him as they would be somebody not named Jose Reyes. Even with the last year of his career, I feel like the Mets bringing him back is such a symbolic gesture,
right,
that they're not going to cut ties that quickly. So hopefully they manage to win the games that he's playing poorly in, and that's kind of then the best-case scenario for everybody, where he still remains on the team, he still has a role, but he's not being glorified by the fan base. And to me, there's no way that a lineup with Walker and Herrera in it would be worse than one of them and Reyes.
Right.
There's no way.
Right, yeah, and it's, you know, it's one of the things that's come up a little bit too around him in terms of performance is, you know, his on-base ability. And, you know, he's had some decent on-base percentages in some of his seasons, but it's been a while. And, yeah, it's I'm sorry. My MacBook screen. Sorry, listeners. My MacBook screen is being
it's
terrible.
Bugging out again?
It's been sort of an ongoing issue. I know all of you care, but You heard plenty about Jeff's MacBook in the past, so now you're hearing about mine.
And I don't have a MacBook, so I can't join into this, but, you know, that's all right.
But yeah, it distracted me from finishing that thought, but what was I saying? Something about Reyes?
Reyes' on-base percentage being lame lately.
Oh, right. Yeah, so he's had some decent ones in some seasons, but he's never been particularly elite in terms of that. You know, a good on-base percentage plus the ability to steal bases, I think, makes for a very nice player.
Mm-hmm.
He just hasn't done both of those things at the same time
right.
in a while. So there, you know, there's that. And then last season, his on-base percentage was like .310, and he played in Toronto and Colorado. And, you know, even if you buy into he was unhappy in Colorado and kind of sulked and, you know, just wasn't there and didn't perform because of it, even then, his numbers coming out of Toronto weren't that great. So, you know, he played in parks that were very friendly to hitters, parks where pitchers constantly have to try to, you know, work around and avoid serving up home runs, and he still didn't get on base at that great of a rate. So, yeah, it sort of, if you read or hear that, oh, Reyes is back, whether it's Friday or Sunday or next Friday or whenever, you know, and the Mets, they got themselves a leadoff hitter. I'm not so sure that that's true. You know, even if the power isn't there and even if the stolen base total is, or the rate, I should say, is half of what it used to be, I'm not so sure that, you know, he makes more sense at the top of the order than anybody else on the team.
I agree completely. Before we get off here, let's just do a quick worried or not worried about a couple of topics here. Chris,
sure.
Are you worried or not worried about the bone spurs reportedly in Syndergaard and Matz's elbows?
I'm going to go with not worried on Syndergaard and somewhat worried on Matz.
Are you not worried on Syndergaard just because he's a freak of nature?
Yeah, slightly. And, it, you know, sort of the fact that he's got a small bone spur that, you know, he's saying feels fine. And I know players aren't always going to disclose
right.
everything. But, you know, he had a rough start in Washington this week, but I really don't think it was that. I think it was just a bad start. And there's almost sort of a comfort in knowing that now, because, you know, he's had a few times that he's reported, you know, soreness, discomfort, right. whatever, with his elbow. And every time they look at the ligaments, they're fine. And now we know that there's actually a, you know, there's something there that would cause him
discomfort. Yeah.
Right. To feel that way, it's not something that's just means, his, you know, he's going to miss a year.
Yeah.
So that to me is, you know, I'd rather he had nothing wrong and didn't have to go to the doctor at all. But there's some strange comfort in that for me. And then with Matz, it's just, you know, they're in comparison to Syndergaard, where they're saying it's a bigger thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little more concerning. I mean, I'm not thinking that he will necessarily be, you know, sent for surgery immediately. But it's, you know, I think I'm going to have that in the back of my mind a little bit more after each one of his starts.
Yeah. And also, you know, he's just one of these guys who seems to get hurt more than the average player over the course of his career so far. So when you hear something like bone spurs, when you couple that with a player who has been hurt a number of times in his career, it seems like there's potential for it to be more serious than for someone like Syndergaard, who seems to be, as I said before, kind of a freak of nature physically. So,
yeah,
worried, not worried about Granderson's calf. As we record this Wednesday night, Granderson did not start because of a sore calf. He was pulled last night after the second rain delay. Yeah. Worried, not worried.
As we record, he's taking hacks in the on-deck circle. Can I wait for the at-bat?
Nope, I do it right now.
I'm going to say not worried. Not to just default to that, but I guess maybe I've become a little bit accustomed to injuries or worn down over the years. But until there is a medical, I don't know what that word just was that I said, until there's a medical diagnosis on something, you know, I try not to react to it too much. So,
okay, this is kind of related to that. Worried, not worried about the Mets' propensity for playing short. Because to me, that's maybe the most worrisome thing this season.
Yeah. I mean, so I'll on the either or, I'll say worried.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
like the look of it. I don't like the implication that it's okay to play short-staffed.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a, like, in the reality of the rules of Major League Baseball in 2016, there's not that much flexibility, right, with the disabled list, and you know, that choice between 15 days without a guy and, you know, balancing that with maybe having 5 days without him but playing short in the meantime.
To me, this would be less worrisome if these guys sat out 2 or 3 days and then didn't hit the disabled list.
Right.
But it seems like the trend has been, like, Lagares, you know, he sat out 3-4 days, got into one game, and then hit the disabled list.
Yeah.
It just, to me, seems like it's a... it hasn't come back to bite them as badly as it could have so far this year. There haven't been too many games where you can point to and say, you know, oh, if they only had a 25th man on the roster, this game would have been winnable. We haven't had a concrete moment like that yet, but I think that it's just a... I don't think it's a great way to go about your business, especially this time of year.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, maybe the rule doesn't need to be changed, and maybe it's sort of by design for this reason. But you know, say you had a 10-day disabled list, right?
Or a 7-day disabled list, yeah.
Right. There's the 7 for the concussions.
Mm-hmm.
But say it was somewhere in that range, you'd probably have an easier time saying, all right, Lagares, you know, bent his thumb into the completely wrong direction, making a great catch. Let's put him on that for a week or a little more. You know, we'll call somebody up, we'll get by, and then we'll have him... You know, he doesn't even have to leave the team necessarily. We'll have him rest for a few days and get into some practice and see how everything feels. And, you know, you can experiment a little more with it. You know, it's sort of a strange thing where, like, if that existed,
mm-hmm.
I think the concern would be that teams would abuse it with pitchers.
Yes.
So it would be interesting, and I'm sure there's no way this would ever fly. But it'd be interesting if there was a different disabled list
for pitchers and position players.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting.
It's, you know, I'm always a little bit surprised, and I think I've said this before too, but I'm always a little surprised teams don't manipulate the back ends of their rosters a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Cycling guys, you know, the last man or last two men in the bullpen, you know, the back end of a bench, you know, sort of using AAA as like an extended piece of the roster.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the difference between a Ty Kelly and an Eric Campbell on the roster isn't so great that you don't want to burn one or the other. You know, you can rotate those guys reasonably well.
Right, and even Logan Verrett and Eric Goodell, same idea. You know, you can, right now they're both on the roster, but they're guys that you could swap out and, you know, no offense to either of them, but not really notice a huge difference.
Right. You know, my question with all this, though, is we're talking about, you know, would a 10-day DL be better than a 15-day DL? Does it really make that much of a difference if it's going to be 10 days or 15 days?
Well, I feel like
I can be convinced either way. I'm not coming at this with a right. position necessarily. I'm really asking the question. Do you think it makes that much of a difference if somebody is out from a, you know, from a game management standpoint, from a season management standpoint, do those 5 days really make a big difference?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they might. The reason it comes to mind for me is that 15 days in the way baseball is scheduled, you know, you're sort of guaranteed that there's, except for some stretches where you have no off days, you're pretty much guaranteed to have one off day in there. But
if not two, depending on the time of the year that the DL stint is happening.
Right. So, yeah. So that's, I mean, obviously, if you're putting a guy in the DL, you're hoping that's the case. You know, say he was borderline. Oh, we've got two off days coming up. So that means he only misses 13 games. You know, that's significant. But I think in a typical 15-day stretch, you're sort of saying, all right, he's going to miss, you know, four full series.
Mm-hmm.
So if you reduce it a little bit, then you're saying, all right, he's going to miss three series, or, you know, maybe two series plus an off day, depending on how things go. So I don't know if it's dramatically different, but I guess I'm just sort of trying to think of a way that it allows teams to react more rapidly to that questionable player.
Okay.
You know, I mean, to counter that, I guess, how many times has a guy been put on the DL and 5 days later, it's like, you know, shit, what do we do? He's healthy.
Does that happen that often?
Right. No, I don't. I can't recall that ever happening. Can you? I can't think of any player who's put on and
part of that is the media perception, right? The media is not reporting, like, you know, in his first day, you know, in his third day in the DL, you know, David Wright looks like the second coming of Barry Bonds in 1996. Like, you know, you just don't hear that because they're not playing in rehab games yet. They're not.
Right. You know, it's like the guy's going to get a certain amount of time off.
Right.
Before he even, you know, goes to St. Lucie and gets in the batting cage or on the mound, whatever it may be.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess it's sort of built in that, like, the system is just not going to let that ever happen. But, yeah, it's, I don't know. It's interesting to think about.
Yeah, to me, roster construction has meant a lot more this year because I feel like in years past, the perception was the Mets had no depth. And the reality in a lot of ways is the Mets had no depth. And they started this year, and you heard that conversation changing. And now that we're a few injuries in, you see that depth wasn't as deep as maybe it was perceived to be. And I just keep thinking of things like, all right, well, you know, if Lagares had hit the DL when that started, when he was able to, would he be back already now? Like, physically, would he be back ready? Maybe. We don't really know. You know, getting Nimmo up is a nice thing, but I don't know if it's all that important of a thing in the long run. So I don't know if there's a practical... What I'm trying to say is I don't know if there's a practical application for that this year in terms of you can point to one specific injury and say, oh, they should have dealt this guy right away because XYZ would have happened. I don't know if we can point to that necessarily, but I do think it is... to me, it's concerning because it just seems this team is very willing to play short on the field, and I don't particularly like that. And they've been lucky that they've had very few extra inning games as well, because playing short and extra innings is incredibly difficult.
Yeah, it is.
Well, all right, Chris. Hopefully, we can have a happy conversation next week.
Yeah.
Hopefully they sweep the Cubs this weekend.
Yes. By the next time you hear us, they will have played the four-game series with the Cubs, and they'll be wrapping up their they will have played the whole three-game series against the Marlins as well.
Yeah, that's true.
So they'll be gearing up to play the Nationals again.
That's all we need.
Hey everyone, Steve Schreiber here. It's time for your This Week in SNY Minute on Amazing Avenue Audio. So today we go back to June 22nd, that was Wednesday, in the game against the Royals, with runners at first and second and Neil Walker up. Royals first baseman Eric Hosmer decided to run in as if he was defending a bunt. So this is with, of course, Neil Walker up, batting right-handed, which he was hitting well over 300. So Gary mentioned it and set Keith off a little bit. And of course, he had one great line, as he typically does.
First and second and nobody out. Hosmer creeping in from first as though he's expecting Walker to bunt.
Are you kidding?
Are you kidding?
It's a cleanup hitter.
And a guy who's hitting 347 this year as a right-hand batter with five home runs from this side of the plate.
I don't understand. And he's kind of playing in no man's land right here.
Now they've got him behind Sesame.
Yeah, but still, get back. I mean,
it's poked foul, and it's 1-1 to Walker.
Osmer's chatting up Cespedes at first base.
Osmer saying, I don't know how you play this in the National League. I thought you guys always bunt. That's why I was in.
I suggest to him that he gets back further.
And now he gets back a little further.
Nice curveball.
Backdoor breaking ball for a strike, 1-2.
Two strikes now. Fourth hitter, bunt was never on. Now it for sure, and Hosmer hasn't moved deeper than where he's at last the entire at bat. That is amazing to me.
1-2 to Walker with Flores on deck, and Duffy takes a look at Cabrera.
Well, Hosmer's now in a little, not to pick on him. He's in a better position now. He could go a little, maybe 5-10 feet deeper.
Three-time Gold Glover.
I know. Got eight to go.
At least. That's just to catch you. He might like to pass you.
And there's Keith with the KO there. That was a beautiful moment between Gary and Keith. So that's all we've got today. This has been your This Week in SNY Minute. I'm Steve Schreiber. Now back to Amazing Avenue Audio.
Hello, Mets fans. This is Aaron York again for Amazing Avenue Audio. And these have been kind of crappy days for the Mets recently. I'm recording on a Tuesday afternoon, which means the Mets just got clobbered by the Nationals 11-4, even though Noah Syndergaard was starting and even though the Mets got out to a 4-0 lead. It turns out that two of the Mets' best pitchers this year, Steven Matz and Noah Syndergaard, both have bone spurs in their throwing elbows. And while both guys sound like they will be able to pitch through the injuries, we don't know if they're going to be as effective as they were at the start of the season when both guys were two of the best pitchers in baseball, and we don't know if they're going to need surgery after the season. It sounds like that's going to be something that needs to happen, so not a lot of fun for Mets fans right now, but I'm going to talk about something that is a lot of fun, and that's how well that James Loney has played since the Mets signed him at the end of May to take over at first base with Lucas Duda out with a back injury. Now, Loney has played surprisingly well for a guy who is just hacking away in the San Diego Padres minor league organization. He was playing for the El Paso Chihuahuas, which is one of the better named minor league clubs, except for the Hartford Yard Goats, or what will hopefully be known as the Binghamton Rumble Ponies. So anyway, Loney was just hanging out at AAA for San Diego, and the Mets were able to acquire him for cash considerations because the Padres have bigger issues to deal with than a minor league first baseman. Their whole situation is a story for another day. But what Loney has given the Mets is someone who's been very consistent. He more often than not, gets a hit in each game. He's got a hit in 14 of his last 15 games with the Mets, and he's even shown a surprising amount of power. He's hit two home runs for the Mets so far, the last one coming in an 8-6 win over Atlanta on June 24th. That was a big home run that the Mets ended up needing as they almost blew an 8-0 lead, ended up hanging on to win 8-6. Ohtani has been a real source of stability in a lineup that we don't even know if they're going to score a run every day, but Ohtani's been someone who's gone out there and he's done what we want him to do. He doesn't strike out all the time. His strikeout rate has been pretty consistent with his career numbers. It's around 12%. He's drawing a few walks, a few more walks than he drew last year with Tampa Bay when his walk rate was 6%. He's moved that up to about 7%. But the power is really surprising. His isolated power is 149. That's the highest it's been since his second year with the Dodgers in 2007. Since then, he's been the guy that we've come to know, someone who makes contact, draws a couple walks, and hits about double-digit home runs, but doesn't really come close to 20 home runs. So what he's done with the Mets at this advanced age, he is 32 years old. He just turned 32 years old in May. What he's doing now is a really nice surprise, especially the power. Now he's probably not going to continue hitting for that kind of power. That's why he was a minor league player at the start of the year, and that's why he had a WRC plus of just 88 with Tampa Bay last year. But Loney's probably going to continue to be a useful player, and if he continues hitting for a little bit of power and getting base hits as often as he has, he's batting 298, 353, 447 for the year. There are going to be some people who say, hey, we should keep playing him even after Lucas Duda comes back. But it's easy to forget how awesome Lucas Duda has been the past 2 years for this club. He's shown the ability to hit 30 home runs and take a bunch of walks. Now, obviously, Duda's going to make more outs. He's going to strike out more than Loney. But the upside of his power is just too much to keep out of the lineup unless Loney starts hitting even more home runs than he has already. He still only has two, although the power numbers are good. Unless he improves even on that, which would be really incredible, then Duda should be able to step back in whenever he comes back. But I just want to get Mets fans ready for the people that are going to want to keep Loney in the lineup if he keeps hitting like this. But even if we do put Duda in the lineup instead of Loney, he could still be really useful as a bat off the bench, as a late-inning replacement somewhere. He's not a great defensive first baseman, although I felt like he had that reputation coming in. Fangraphs has him as a below-average guy for pretty much his whole career, with some seasons worse than others. So he's not giving the Mets too much on defense that Duda isn't giving them. The bottom line is that James Loney has been really awesome, but that doesn't mean that he's been better than Lucas Duda. But it does mean that he can continue to be helpful for the Mets for the entire season and not just while they're waiting for Lucas Duda to come back. This has been Aaron York for Amazing Avenue Audio.
Welcome to Forgotten Mets. I'm your host this week, Milo Tabey. A couple weeks ago, we profiled Ronnie Cedeno. He was a shortstop on the 2012 Mets. This week, we're focusing on another member of the 2012 team, arguably the most beloved number 33 in franchise history, talking, of course, about Vinny Rotino. Indeed. Vinny had an interesting skill set. He was basically a right-handed utility man who was also able to catch. Over the course of his career, he started 293 minor league games behind the plate. His career started on a promising note in the Brewers organization. He posted solid numbers at the AA and AAA levels between 2005 and 2007. Rotino only had cups of coffee in Milwaukee, however, appearing in 18 games over three seasons. He had a short stint with the Marlins, got some more major league time before he joined the Mets in 2012. The team purchased his contract after demoting Chris Schwinden, who would be an interesting Forgotten Mets candidate. Rotino never caught with the Mets, however. He split time with Lucas Duda in the outfield when Lucas Duda still played the corner outfield. He would also start against lefties at first base, giving Ike Davis a rest. Vinny produced hits against some pretty well-known southpaws around the league. David Price, Cole Hamels, Andy Pettit. He hit a pair of home runs as well in his 18 games as a Met. But otherwise, he hit just 182 and would lose his roster spot to another forgotten Mets candidate, left-hander Justin Hampson. Rotino would receive big league time with the Indians later in the season before joining the Oryx Buffaloes in Japan, becoming one of the rare players to spend time with both the Bisons and the Buffaloes in one season. I'll wrap things up with some fun Vinny Rotino facts. His first major league home run off Clayton Richard of the Padres came at 32 years old in his 32nd major league game. That's kind of cool. The listener can purchase a game-used Vinny Rotino Mets jersey for $79 on eBay. Not a bad value. And during one minor league game, he played all nine positions of the field, including pitcher. I found some audio of him speaking about this game while he was playing with the KBO in South Korea.
You should include pitcher, right?
No, I don't pitch. I pitched once.
Once?
Yes, I pitched once. It was an A-ball, low level of minor leagues.
Mm-hmm.
Just played all the different positions in one game.
In one game?
Yeah, it was just a fun thing. It was the last game of the season.
Right.
There you have it. Now 36 years old, Vinny is still playing in the White Sox organization. He's playing in AAA. I'm sure all of us at Amazon Avenue wish Vinny Rotino all the best in the future. Hopefully the White Sox call him up in September. Until then, this has been Milo Tabey with this week's edition of Forgotten Mets.
James Wagner is in a really interesting position as a beat writer this year. He used to cover the Washington Nationals, and now he is covering the New York Mets for the New York Times. He has a very interesting story about life and writing, and Chris gets to chat with him right now. So follow him on Twitter at @byjameswagner. And enjoy this conversation with James and Chris McShane.
Joining us this week on Amazing Avenue Audio is James Wagner. If you are a Mets fan on Twitter, you know him as Wags, thanks to several other beat writers. But he just recently made the switch from covering the Nationals for the Washington Post to covering the Mets for the New York Times. So, James, welcome on the podcast and welcome to the Mets side of things.
Cool. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me, and glad to be here.
So last year was a bit of a roller coaster for Mets fans, and the Mets themselves, you know, the way things unfolded and just sort of how crazy things were from the end of July to the end of the season. In that process, we heard a lot about what was going on in the Nationals clubhouse. What was that season like? I know you're around, you know, before you made this switch, you were around the Mets a lot since the teams play, you know, so many times each year. But what was that couple of months like on the other side?
Yeah, I mean, it's the, you know, as you know, like, you know, the Nats were, you know, in first place, you know, early in the season, and they were in first place for a decent amount of time before they kind of, you know, relinquished the lead to the Mets. I think it was like around, you know, mid-summertime. Yeah, and you know, and then after that, the Nats had to play catch up the entire time. But I still remember, you know, the Nats being in first place going into, was just around trade deadline time. It was the end of July. The Nets had a lead. I think it was a three-game lead going into New York. They played a series there. You know, the Nationals bullpen, you know, was an issue last season. It undermined them, you know, several times at key moments, and that was one of them. And people, you know, still remember because it stood out. You know, the bullpen failed them. There were some moves by the manager Matt Williams, I think, that were, they were much debated and questioned that series too, you know, as to what relievers used when, and, you know, when, you know, sticking with a starter, you know, too long. I think it was a game where, you know, he stuck with, you know, Joe Ross too long. I think Lucas Duda helped, you know, played a pivotal role in that series. And, you know, and then the Nats left New York tied I mean, after that, you know, things really weren't the same again for the rest of the way for the Nationals. You know, the Mets, you know, took over first place. You know, they had added Cespedes, Uribe, and you know, Kelly Johnson a couple weeks before. And just at the trade deadline, and those players made a huge difference. I mean, the Mets offense, you know, was transformed. They took off in the second half. You know, the Nats still had a chance. I think there in like September, they were still down several games, and they played each other in D.C. And then just got smoked by the Mets again. So I think, yeah, it was the swing of emotions even on the national side was, you know, interesting to watch. I think overall what stood out to me more than anything is that I think the Nats were almost taken by surprise by the Mets. I think they knew that they would be good. The pitching was good when getting there. I think maybe it arrived earlier than they thought. And they were better than they thought they would be that soon.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So you started this season covering the Nationals as well. How did the switch come about?
Yeah, without getting into like, kind of boring, personnel stuff. But yeah, I mean, I've worked for the Washington Post for the last, I worked for the Washington Post for about, 6 years. You know, I started at the Post in 2010. I can't say the Post in New York, sorry, the Washington Post. You know, the Post in New York means something else. But, I worked there for about 6 years. You know, I'd covered high school sports. You know, I'm from the area. I covered high school sports for about a year and a half, 2 years, and then, moved to the Nationals beat in 2012. You know, the Washington Post had not covered baseball with two people before on one beat up until 2012. And then myself and my colleague, former colleague Adam Kilgore, covered the team together for about, 3 years. Then he left the beat. Then a new beat reporter joined me, Chelsea Janes. She stayed, when I left. But yeah, I mean, I'm from the area. I loved working for the Washington Post. It was a dream of mine to work for, my hometown paper. But the covering the Mets for the New York Times was also a unique challenge, something new, something I wanted to try. The New York Times has sort of a different style of covering baseball, and it's something that appealed to me. And then going from one great newspaper to another great newspaper was fun, and a challenge I wanted to try.
Yeah. Well, congrats on the new gig. And
thanks, man.
So I guess since Mets fans, may not have read everything in the Post, although I really enjoyed the work that you did there and Adam, over the last few seasons, I thought it was some of the best coverage of baseball that there really was. But for Mets fans who might not know you or your work too well yet, what is it that you love about baseball? What is it that you hate in the game? How do you look at the sport?
Yeah, I mean, I guess let's give the more personal answer, but I mean, I've grown up around baseball. It's, I played since a little kid, and also just a sport that appealed to me the most. And more than anything, I'm a Nicaraguan American. My dad's from the United States. My mom's from Nicaragua. It's Central America. Baseball is part of the culture in Latin America. It's huge. So, I mean, it was not just, not just something I liked, but it's something that, it's the national sport in Nicaragua. So it's a big part of my life culturally in that way too. I lived overseas. Growing up, I grew up in Latin America as well, and other places like Venezuela, where baseball is huge as well. So it was, whether I wanted it to be or not, it's always going to be a part of my life, just based on the places I lived and where I'm from. So, yeah, I mean, I just when I wanted to become a sports reporter, baseball was kind of the most obvious and natural fit. And also now, I mean, I'm a native Spanish speaker through my mom, so the chance to give Latino players, Spanish-speaking baseball players, a voice that don't have one, it has always meant a lot to me. I think sometimes they're misunderstood, really just, they're not understood, period, or not heard from as often as they should be, even though they make up, a large percentage of the players. I think that has always meant a lot to me. I think that's something that still appeals a lot to me. There's a interesting subculture of, Latino players in baseball that I find that interesting and worth writing about. So, yeah, I mean, not just the sport itself, and, baseball is a complicated and intense and interesting sport, but on top of that, just the cultural layers to it, I think, were always been fascinating to me, and something that, you know, I did at the Washington Post, and, you know, hope to continue it into the New York Times.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, you know, it's about time that baseball made it mandatory that these players have translators. Yeah. But, you know, I think it's the Mets have a couple of their most beloved players, Yoenis Cespedes and Bartolo Colon. You know, they prefer to do interviews in Spanish, so translation is definitely great, but I think, you know, the ability for you to conduct that interview without a translator sort of, you know, opens things up.
Yeah, I mean, the interpreters, like, should have been mandatory in baseball a long time ago. You know, teams should have had it, you know. You know, players that came from, you know, Asia, Japan, you know, whether it's Japan or South Korea or whatever it would be, I mean, or Taiwan, I mean, sometimes, you know, they had in their contracts, they had, you know, provisions that it would get them an interpreter. But, you know, Latino players, you know, didn't have that. You know, they had to learn English in the minor leagues or had to learn English at the academies or in the majors. But, yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense that, you know, that these guys have that. I mean, these are important players. They're some of the best players. I mean, for marketing wise, the fact that they can, you know, express themselves, you know, more clearly and deeper, you know, I think it only helps, you know, make them more human to people. So it's not just like the language, but just, you know, understanding it at a deeper level, their culture, you know, all those things. And yeah, I mean, as I wouldn't put it all on the MLB and the players union, but, you know, journalism as an industry, I think, sort of, and maybe failed in that sense in not getting, you know, enough Spanish-speaking baseball reporters.
Yeah. Yeah, so just switching gears a little bit to back to the Mets and what's going on with them now. You know, you sort of came over in an interesting time. There were already a lot of injuries, I think, on your first day on the Mets beat.
Yeah.
There are more potential ones recently. You know, the team has sort of been sputtering, but the Nationals have too. You know, we're recording this one game into the Mets and that series, so the Mets at the moment are four games out of first place. You know, what's your sense of the room right now with the Mets? You know, I think, you know, the famous phrase or destination is Panic City, you know, after Sandy Alderson said it last year, and I think that mood is definitely there among fans at this point, starting to question the whole season. But, you know, what's your sense of that room right now?
I think the players are fine. I think they know it's a long season. You know, obviously probably frustrated that the offense can't be, you know, more consistent and more productive on a regular basis. But, you know, I would say, you know, what stood out to me more than anything is, you know, Terry Collins, you know, I know he kind of, you know, obviously the leader of the team is the manager, but just like the level of frustration, you know, I've seen with him even in the past, you know, two plus weeks, just with injuries, you know, I mean, no manager, you know, they want to talk about baseball, how they're managing their team, strategy, you know, getting players right, you know, how a player's doing well, you know, things like that. You don't want to spend the majority of their time talking about who's hurt, how they're hurt, how much they're hurt, how much time they'll miss, how he will manage them through an injury, if he's more worried about leaving them in a game because they're injured, you know, stuff like that. It's just consumed so much of, you know, the discourse the last, you know, two plus weeks. I think that it's kind of worn on him. I think there are an incident, as you guys know, where just it was so open, you know, with him, with the cameras rolling, about how frustrated he was with the injuries when he talked to, you know, one of the PR guys. But yeah, I mean, it stood out to me, and I think, We'll see what the team will do. I mean, at a certain point, you know, this team is built on pitching and specifically starting pitching. And, you know, when injuries happen to those guys, I think that's probably the most alarming, because, you know, they've stayed afloat because their pitching has been so good. And if that's undermined in any way, I think they're in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's not the worst injury news yet, you know, but hearing that two of the four best pitchers, and not to take away from Bartolo Colon, because he's been excellent this year, you know, I mean, he's third on the team in ERA right now, but two of the four young, hard-throwing pitchers, you know, dealing with these bone spurs that Noah Syndergaard may or may not have, depending on who you ask, but yeah, that it's concerning. You know, it's not, they're not season-ending sort of things, but there are things that, you know, are going to be in the back of everybody's mind going forward. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And, you know, we hear a lot about players the Mets are looking at. You know, they're looking at Yuli Escobar. They're, you know, said to be interested in Yunel Escobar. But they brought back Jose Reyes. So I guess that my last question for today. I know everybody's had a take on Reyes coming back. What do you think of that situation and the way that they're handling it?
Yeah, I mean, personally, it probably doesn't really matter what I think of that is, but I think I'll say that, like, you know, I mean, the Mets are probably the only place, maybe if not the only place, one of the few places that he could actually really do this, that he could get a second chance. I mean, I think, you know, I think in the Times, one of my colleagues wrote a story, just a broader story about domestic violence and baseball players, you know, with Reyes and Chapman. It was interesting, you know, he spoke to a domestic violence expert who kind of said, you know, that the player that, you know, you had that a spouse or whatever it was, be, you know, the victim would be, you know, leery of speaking out or talking about things if they knew that it would affect, you know, their spouse's career forever. And also on top of that, that in order to really, you know, improve the situation and get better, you know, the so-called, you know, domestic violence abuser maybe have to go somewhere, you know, that knows them, somewhere like home, somewhere that can help them, around people that they trust, that can help them get better. So I think that stood out to me because, you know, this is home, you know, this is home for Jose Reyes. He spent 12 years with the Mets. He signed there as a 16-year-old. He grew up in the organization, became an all-star, became an adult, you know, and he's around people he trusts, you know, people that he's known for a while, from Sandy Alderson to Terry Collins. So I think, you know, if he's going to try to get better and, you know, and try to become a better person in that sense and mature and fix, you know, fix the problems that led to that incident with his wife, you know, I think, you know, this could be the place to do so. So, yeah, I mean, like, you know, should he be blackballed forever and, you know, and ostracized and, you know, in, you know, from baseball forever because of that? You know, I don't know. I mean, it's probably a larger issue and maybe he shouldn't, but, you know, he obviously paid a penalty. You know, the Mets, you know, I think they kind of framed it the best way they could, you know, when they explained about bringing him back, and said that, you know, that, you know, he paid a penalty, that there'll be conditions of him staying in terms of continuing counseling. So in that sense, you know, I think this was probably, you know, if Reyes was going to get a path back to baseball, I think, you know, this was maybe the only place and way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that sums it up well, and we'll wrap it up there, but thanks again for coming on. And listeners, you can find James on Twitter at @byjameswagner, and look for his work in the Times. And yeah, the piece you referenced there, I thought was a very good one. And Gary Cohn had brought it up on the broadcast as well, the other day. And just sort of that angle that you just spoke to was something that I don't think a lot of us had considered, from, you know, the victim's sure. perspective. So yeah, I definitely recommend checking that out. And, of course, checking out James's work from here on out.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. And, you know, anytime.
All right.
Before we bring in Lucas Vlahos with the weekly stat, I just want to say good luck and fare thee well to our friend Noel Purcell. He is taking a step away from Mazen Avenue as he goes on to become a lawyer. So one of these days when you're in jail and you need to call a lawyer to get you out, hopefully you call our pal Noel. In all seriousness, good luck, buddy. You know, yeah, good luck. I don't know what else to say. I guess I thought I had something more profound than that to say, but I don't. Good luck, Noel, and take it away, Lucas.
Hello, Met fans, and welcome to the Weekly Stat. Recording this on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, after another horrible loss to the Nationals, 5-0, after a couple rain delays, as the Mets offense continues to sputter. And that had been what I had meant to talk about originally for this segment, just to rant about the struggling Met offense and how the season is on the brink of collapse, but I got a little sick of making myself more upset about the 2016 Mets. So hopefully to brighten both my day and yours, I thought we'd look at the aspect of the team that is performing up to expectations and perhaps even beyond them, and that is, of course, our starting pitching. We know that 40% of that rotation now has bone spurs in their elbow, so who knows what's going to happen in the future, but right now we can celebrate what they've done to date. So starting with our base stats, the Mets rotation is currently second in ERA at 3.3. They trail the Cubs, who have some serious run preventing skills on defense that the Mets obviously lack. But the Mets are first in FIP at 3.1 and first in FWAR at 10.8. Problems with FIP and FWAR aside, this is just the simplest go-to metric that we really have available. So we've already seen that the Mets are dominating the season, the Mets rotation is dominating the season, and it's not particularly close between them and the next best rotation in baseball. One of the big statistical points that people are celebrating this year is Clayton Kershaw's absolutely absurd strikeout-to-walk ratio. Even with the recent back issues, he currently has... I can pull it up right here. Clayton Kershaw is currently sitting at 145 strikeouts against 9 walks, which is good for a 16.11 strikeout-to-walk ratio. Easily the best in baseball. Second best is Noah Syndergaard at 7.53, so it's not even particularly close. However, along that same vein, the Mets as a club are currently dominating this statistic. Kershaw's doing the best he can to help the Dodgers out, but the Mets right now, for their entire rotation, has a 4.25 strikeout-to-walk ratio. The next best in baseball is the Dodgers at 3.79. So the Mets are blowing every other rotation in baseball out in this metric, similar to how Kershaw is doing to every other starting pitcher in baseball, though obviously to not as extreme a degree. To appreciate this a bit more, we can look at it in historical context, and obviously strikeout and walk numbers have fluctuated over the years, so it's not a perfect metric to compare eras, but if we look back to 1969, the Mets rotation right now has the highest strikeout to walk ratio of any rotation ever at 4.25. So that's really impressive on its own. It might be just one or perhaps a combination of two metrics, strikeouts and walks, but it's very rare obviously completely unheard of for a team to strike out this many batters and walk this few. Looking at the second place team on the list from 1969 onwards, we see the 2011 Phillies, and that ties in nicely to the second stat I wanted to bring up today. The 2011 Phillies rotation, as I'm sure we all remember, was ridiculously, stupidly good. It was Roy Halladay, Cliff Leahy, Roy Oswalt, Cole Hamels, and then good seasons from Joe Blanton and Vance Worley. And they posted 26 wins in 1,064 innings. Now, prior to the season, because I like wishcasting these things, I mentioned it when I was on the podcast with Jeff, and I also wrote about it, I believe, how I thought the Mets rotation this year had a chance to match these Phillies. And it's very important to emphasize had a chance here. Whenever you're pushing for a record as absurd as 26 WAR from your rotation, it's always a small chance. Let's check in on that briefly. The 2011 Phillies rotation, like I said, posted 26 wins in 1,064 innings. Little division, and that comes out to 0.02443 WAR per inning pitched. So, best mark of all time. The 2016 Mets to date have pitched 441 in the third innings. They've accrued 10.8 WAR. Do some division, and you come out with 0.02447 WAR per inning pitched. So the Mets rotation, which to date is getting a breakout performance from Noah Syndergaard, but also, I think we can comfortably say, an underperformance from Matt Harvey, is slightly, very by the slimmest of margins, exceeding the 2011 Phillies. It's less than half a season of data, and the margin is very slim, but at this pace, the Mets starters will match the greatest rotation of all time. So that's really an impressive achievement, even if it's only for half a season, and even if the Met rotation blows up in the next 2 weeks, and Noah Syndergaard and Steven Matz, well, I guess Matz is more likely to undergo surgery than Thor at this point, but we can point to this as part of the Mets were absolutely brilliant this year, even if the offense never comes around and the season putters out. Part of this Mets team was the best starting rotation of all time. And that's your weekly stat.
Look, I don't know what to tell you guys anymore. The Mets are just not playing good baseball. They can't hit, they can't pitch, they can't play the field, they can't run. There's just nothing going right. They are currently 5 games back. They're tied for second because the Marlins just lost. It's Wednesday afternoon, so they haven't been swept by the Nats yet, but I'm going to go ahead and venture that they will by the time you listen to this podcast, because it's Max Scherzer and Logan Verrett and Alejandro Diaz is getting starts again. And I just don't even have no words for this. I think this is worse than last year, last June and July, because I think we all expected more coming into this year, so it hurts more when they just blatantly fail us. And who the heck knows what kind of replacements are coming in. Syndergaard and Matz have their bone spurs. Matz might be out, might not be. Syndergaard says he's fine. Harvey's still pitching like Harvey. Cologne was hit. It's so ugly. They've got Jose Reyes coming in, I mean, probably a week at this point. Who knows if he can help? There's not much. Darno is throwing better. Darno is hitting better, but it's not helping. And it's just, I don't know what to tell you guys, but if you want to panic, you're probably allowed to start panicking.
Well, folks, that does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you to all of our contributors for contributing, and thanks to all of you for listening. You can email the show at podcast@amazingavenueaudio.com. You can always find Amazing Avenue on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Just search for Amazing Avenue. Of course, we are on the interwebs at amazingavenue.com. Go there for more Mets content than you probably should be reading in this dire state of the team. You know, we don't want to give you a heart attack or anything, but look out for the good news on there. Hopefully there is a fair amount of that. You can follow all of our contributors on Twitter. I am at Brian Needs a Nap. Chris is at Chris McShane. Kate is at Kate E. Feldman. Steve is at _MrMet. Lucas is at ElVlahos343. Aaron is at APY5000. And Milo, who you just met for the first time this week, Milo Tabi, is at Milo Tabi, at MILOTAIBI. Thanks again for checking this out. And by the time we talk next week, hopefully we have some more positive things to say. And so until then, let's go Mets.
Beer, mustard, honey, if that's not got your taste buds going, I don't know what will. Well, the sticky sausages aren't just for Debbie, they're for you too, because Asda's extra special chipolata sausages are just £1.75. You can get all these ingredients at Asda, as well as the full recipe at asda.com/James Martin.
Selected stores subject to availability. Chipolatas 375 grams.